Welcome to Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the weekly podcast. If you start with the first Gulf War, the United States has been at war in Iraq for 24 years now. And now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Martin Dempsey, says the war against ISIS in Iraq and Syria could go on another 4 years. But that's really nothing. Leon Panetta, the prior defense secretary, says the war against ISIS could last at least 30 years. So it's a generational war, but that's really nothing. President Bush talked about staying in Iraq for 50 years. In fact, John McCain even upped that, upping the ante to a 100-year war in Iraq. Now, in addition to the longevity of the forever war, General Dempsey is also promoting the use of ground troops in Iraq as well. Dr. Paul, the Obama administration's policy approach to ISIS specifically has been inscrutable all along. I mean, it's been loaded with logical inconsistencies that we've talked about. And now with the firing of Secretary Chuck Hagel, I have to wonder if he's just a sacrificial lamb for all of this obvious confusion of the intervention by the administration, or whether this sets the stage for a new focus of aggressiveness and Obama interventionism.
You know, sometimes it is hard to figure out what their real motives are because, you know, you can't quite believe that they're stupid enough to follow policies that they've been following for the past 24 years, but they continue to do it. The worse they get, the more they ante it up and do the same thing over and over again. If it is not stupidity, then is it just a bad philosophy going badly and having unintended consequences, or is there some ulterior motives? And I don't think we can give the full answer to that. About all we can say is what they've been doing hasn't worked. It doesn't make any sense. And now, after the election, Obama wants to sort of clean up the act because he's been getting a lot of grief, from the neocons. Not that he isn't sympathetic and not that he hasn't been pro-war, but he still hasn't satisfied those neocons who strongly opposed Chuck Hagel from being, Secretary of Defense. So, but he had to go. There's a lot of stories out there that he never was the Secretary of Defense. A small group in the White House actually called all the shots. And yet he represented a viewpoint that was closer to what Obama pretended to be, you know, a little less hawkish. And he actually admitted that he made a mistake when he voted for the Iraq war. So there has been a lot of people, neocons and others, who strongly opposed his appointment, but saw this as a time, you know, to get rid of him. I think it's very bad news. Not that he was doing a great job or was in charge, and not that he has prevented a whole lot, but he did have a little bit different, you know, approach. I think he was less aggressive. And this might have been the reason that he was kicked out. He wasn't quite as aggressive on going after Assad. So this is a serious problem, especially in light of the change in the Congress and the change in the Senate. So we who had hoped for a better foreign policy and a less interventionist foreign policy, and at times became a little optimistic about this, I don't think we have as much room for optimism right now, because those new members of Congress, in particular the Senate, are wildly hawkish. And along with this change, I think that we're looking for a much more active war, more killing, more spending, more economic downturn, and all the consequences of war. What bothers me is some of the suggestions they have for replacing Hagel. And the one that's on top of the list right now, this Michelle Flournoy, is something else. If anybody looked at her record and wondered where she's coming from, of course, she'll get a lot of sympathy. She's a woman. She can be the first woman Secretary of Defense, and she'll make Margaret Thatcher look like a pussycat when it comes to the use of the military. So she's been in the Defense Department, and she's had a lot of government experience. She's known as a wild hawk. But you know what is interesting, where the real evidence comes out, is after she left officially being in the Secretary of Defense Department, she, with somebody else, started this Center for new American security. Oh, everybody's for American security. Maybe you and I ought to join up and say, what can we do? We believe in security. But what's interesting, of course, is they were promoting one agenda. But what is important is, where did they get the money to have this new organization to promote American security? The defense contractors finance the whole thing. Now, you want to talk about blatant military-industrial complex influence. It is there. It is sad. And the American people must be thinking about football games and Ferguson and thinking that every fight in the world is just in Ferguson. It's between some hoodlums and some police who overreact. But there are some other big events, and what's going on in the Department of Defense and with us in the Middle East and the disaster of that foreign policy. And instead of seeing signs that we might change it for the better, all we're seeing is more of the same and maybe getting much worse. And like you said in your opening statement, they're all planning to be there for many, many years, which means two things. One, it'll end when we go bankrupt. And in the meantime, we will continue to lose our liberties, because it's the sentiment when a country's at war that we're supposed to give up a little bit of our freedoms because we have an enemy. And now look at ISIS. They are horrible. We got to stop them. So therefore, give up a little bit of more of our freedoms. And yet people write that and deliberately say, yes, this is what we must do. The enemy is so bad, we have to give up our liberties to make our freedoms last, to protect our Constitution, violate the Constitution, violate the American people's freedom in order to save freedom and the Constitution. Totally bizarre.
I think it's laughably presumptuous for somebody like General Dempsey to say, well, it will take us 4 years to prevail in this. You know, we say that the first victim of war is the truth, but another early victim of war is always the plan. I like boxer Mike Tyson's expression that everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And it just seems utterly arbitrary for these people to issue these timelines or guidelines for Panetta to say, well, we'll win this, we'll prevail, but it will take us 30 years. Where do they get this? Where does Dempsey get this 4 years business?
Well, who knows? But it seems like the years may vary from one to the other. But the theme is the war must continue, and they can't win, so therefore it has to continue. In the old days, when there was a little bit more respect for the Constitution, if it was thought to be in America's best interests and we were threatened, you actually had a declaration of war, and you had a precise target, and you had a precise ending. And disregarding maybe the history of World War One and even what led up to World War Two, still, that attitude was quite a bit different. And when you think militarily of what was accomplished against the Nazis and Japan in like slightly over 3 years, it's pretty amazing. And yet 10,000 radical Islamists, and there were fewer of those when they actually started, was a breakaway from Al-Qaeda, started off, and we couldn't handle them. And they're winning the war. They're beating us. They're chasing They've about taken over a third of Iraq and a large portion of Syria. And everything we do, we increase their numbers. Now there's claims, well, they might have 200,000 people in their support. So that means the sentiment is pro-radicalism. And I believe it's a continuation of a natural tendency for people to be disgusted with the war, those people who are living there, and side finally with those who say, we're going to get rid of the foreigners and we don't like foreign occupation. And even though they might not say, oh yeah, ISIS, they're a grand group of people and we like them, they might say, well, they're the least of the worst choices we have, and they go with them. So our policies do exactly the opposite of what they believe they're trying to do. So I'm afraid this plan for a long war is accurate, unless the American people wake up.
There are indications that at least in some corners of the legislative branch, people are feeling their oats a little bit. Maybe it's the results of the election, but talking about wresting control away from the administration or reclaiming the right to authorize actions in Syria, or even a declaration of war, by the way, on ISIS. And I'd like to get your comments on that.
Well, you know, the first thing I thought about was, you know, I did that, you know, when they were debating and ready to go to war, and I was in the committee. to debate the resolution, which was just saying to the president, if you think it's necessary, go to war. This was the invasion for 2003. We were debating it in 2002. But that's when I brought up the declaration of war issue. And I said, I'm going to offer this as an amendment. And I said, I'm not for it. I'm against the war. But I want you to vote on it because you're ducking the issue. If it's a war, it's a war, and you should declare it. So I was trying to embarrass them into it. And I said, I have no intention on voting for this. And, of course, they didn't want to be on record as declaring war. And there was all this kind of malarkey on why you can't declare war anymore. So it was everybody voted against it. Now, there is this proposal, maybe that we ought to declare war against ISIS. I don't think that is exactly the same. So I don't know what the real motivation is with a declaration of war, because ISIS, it's like declaring war against terrorism, and terrorism happens to be a tactic, and the radical Islamists are terrorists too, and identifying them, it becomes very difficult.
Dr. Paul, in this context of our discussion of foreign policy and empire and war, I do have to mention the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. You have a lot of initiatives going on. There's the Campaign for Liberty and your Ron Paul School curriculum and many more. But the Ron Paul Institute is, for me, it's been absolutely indispensable for important information about these foreign policy issues, for insights that we just don't get from the mainstream media. They do a great job. Daniel McAdams does a great job running that organization for you.
Yes, and it's come about because Daniel worked for me for almost 10 years. He was the researcher for my foreign policy early on. And when we were getting ready to leave Washington after I decided not to run again, he came up with this idea, and he didn't want to quit talking about it. The foreign policy. So he and I got together, and he does so much of the work, especially the website, and he gets a lot of good material out there, and he has a real instinct and ability to find information that you're not going to hear on the news or read in the newspapers, and he has contacts and has met a lot of people around the world. So he's very, very good and very, very bright. And right now, I believe that it represents probably not exactly the only, but really the very best organization right now to present a non-interventionist foreign policy, because Obama really killed the progressive Democrats' goal of non-intervention or less war. And therefore, they're not with us. It seems like it has fallen on the shoulders of libertarian conservative constitutionalists to come together, although we go out of our way to invite those from the other area of the spectrum. Because, for instance, on the board is Dennis Kucinich, and we welcome people like that who will honestly look at foreign policy and endorse it and disregard the pressure of the political parties.
Well, I saw a pretty heartfelt plea for help and support for the Ron Paul Institute from you the other day. And this one did not look like it was a plea for money written by a copywriter. It looked like something straight from your heart.
Yes, and it is. It's always been a little more difficult to raise money for foreign policy. It's easy to raise money, say, with conservatives regarding the UN. It was easy to raise money for the Federal Reserve. It's real easy to raise money for political things. Being in office, whether running for Congress or the presidency, the money was not difficult to come by. But if you have an organization strictly designed for peace and to try to stop wars, for some reason it doesn't grab the people's attention, yet I think it's so important. And it's been difficult to raise the money, and we're holding in there, but we do need the funding. We want to add a staff person. Daniel has moved to Texas. We do have an office to run, and there's so many projects that we have. We want to get young people more involved than ever and get more internships involved. So there's an open-ended opportunity to promote these viewpoints, but like everything else, it costs money, and that's one of the difficult things to do, but I had to make the request, and uh, And so far, we're getting a couple dollars in, but we still have a long way to go.
Well, by all means, listeners should mark the site ronpaulinstitute.org for the basic information that it provides, the commentary, and the insights in the news you don't get otherwise. And in addition to that, you can make a tax-deductible contribution to the Ron Paul Institute at that address. It's ronpaulinstitute.org. Dr. Paul, thank you. Another informative conversation, of course, and a great podcast. And don't forget that Dr. Paul's perspective and comments can be heard easily and regularly by subscribing to our weekly podcasts on iTunes. I'm Charles Goyette.